Okay. So let's start on page 101. I love the first sentence. Judaism is less a philosophical system than a field of tensions. You know, that for most Western readers, that is really bothersome. Because we want resolution. We want the truth. We want to know the answer. And isn't it interesting that Judaism, which is a product of Eastern mentality, not of Western, is happy. Okay. So isn't it interesting that the statement that Sachs makes really flies in the face of our own Western idea of what the truth is? Because what he's really saying is, don't go to the Bible and expect to get answers to everything. Go to the Bible in order to understand the tensions that are involved, because the most important thing about studying the Bible is knowing the right question, not necessarily getting the right answer. And look what he says. Excuse me. Judaism is less a philosophical system than a field of tensions between universalism and particularism, the many and the few, between exile and redemption, priests and prophets, cyclical and linear time, and so on through a long list of polarities. So this is a very important insight, because it'll change the way that we understand the text. Because now we won't be looking for how do we resolve all these issues. We'll be looking for what I would call the existential phenomenological experience of the people who are writing about what their encounter with the divine was like. And I have this great clip from a movie called The International, where this older gentleman says there's a big difference between truth and fiction. Fiction has to make sense. Right? So we wouldn't expect the biblical passages to ultimately make sense, because what are they? They are the personal revelations of the experience of people with the divine in different cultures at different times. And the result of that is you might actually find contradiction and no conclusions and things left unresolved, because that's the way the biblical text works. Okay. On the next page, 102, he says, the conflict runs deep, but it is a tension, not a contradiction. What the prophets were saying is that Judaism is a monotheism, not a dualism. There is one world, not two. If we love God, then we must love our fellow human beings, the neighbor and the stranger. If we seek God's justice, we must practice justice. If we call for God's forgiveness, we too must be forgiving. To compartmentalize our relationship with God and with our fellow human beings, caring about one while neglecting the other, is just as such a dualism. The priest reminded people of their duties to God. The prophet reminded them of their duties to humankind. One without the other is unsustainable and indefensible. And I think that's it's so telling about what happens in our political world today, because our political world today is made up of people who are opposed to each other. They've stopped, you know, they don't understand the role of the prophet, which was a message to everyone on the basis of love your neighbor as yourself. More often than not, we ascribe to the priests of culture who tell us who's in and who's out. And we live on that basis rather than on the prophetic basis, which teaches us that we have to have a much, much different view of our role in relation to other people. So now we skip over to 106, and there's this great passage here, which is a citation. It starts off with vengeance, and he's talking about René Girard's book, Violence and the Sacred. And he says, this telling passage about vengeance. Vengeance is a vicious circle whose effect on primitive societies can only be surmised. For us, the circle has been broken. We owe our good fortune to one of our social institutions above all, our judicial system, which serves to deflect the menace of vengeance. The system does not suppress vengeance. Rather, It effectively limits itself to a single act of reprisal enacted by a sovereign authority specializing in this particular function. The decisions of the judiciary are inevitably presented as the final word on vengeance. And you'll remember Sachs' discussion of why vengeance is such a horrible sin, because it is continuous. It never ends. Reprisal after reprisal after reprisal is the extinction of the species. So he says Sachs is writing, and he says at the bottom of this page, the last full paragraph, Girard's theory confirms the view of Albo. Sacrifice, as with meat eating, entered Judaism as a substitute for violence. It also helps us understand the profound insights of the prophets that sacrifices are not ends in themselves, but part of the Torah's program to create a world redeemed from the otherwise interminable cycle of revenge. The other part of that program, and God's greatest desire, is a world governed by justice. That, we recall, was his first charge to Abraham. Okay? So there you see one more example of why the Levitical constitution of Judaism must include statements about the limit of revenge, eye for an eye, not an eye for everybody else's eye, and why it must have a terminal process to it, right? Because otherwise it will destroy the entire culture. Okay. So unless you have something else to add, somebody in the group, I'm going to skip over now to page 111. All right? Okay. Let's go to page 111. In his book, Rumor of Angels, it's right in the middle of the page there, the American sociologist Peter Berger describes what he calls signals of transcendence. Phenomena within the human situation that point to something beyond. Among them, he includes humor and hope. There is nothing in nature that explains our ability to reframe painful situations in such a way that we can laugh at them. Nor is there anything that can explain the human capacity to find meaning, even in the depth of suffering. And of course, you can think of Viktor Frankl's book, written after the Holocaust, right? The whole point is, what Sachs is trying to say is, humans are not just evolved animals, because we have these, in particular, this capacity, which is not found anywhere else in nature. Okay, so at the bottom of the page, though Berger does not include it, one of the signs of transcendence is surely the instinctive human wish to give thanks. Right? A lion hardly ever prays for his meal. Okay. So the point is that it isn't just that Leviticus forms the constitutional document of Judaism, and it isn't just that it gives us a cure for the endless cycle of revenge. It also highlights those unique human characteristics that set us apart from the rest of creation. And one of those is thanksgiving. Right? He says at the bottom of 112, and we're going to look a lot at 113. Our morning prayers open with the dawn's blessing, in which we give thanks to God for giving us back our consciousness after sleep. For the human body and our restored soul, the earth we stand on, and the freedom with which we rise, and so on, through a whole litany of thanks. What this does to foreground the background, focusing our attention on things we normally take for granted. This is really important because, obviously, Leviticus is pulling forward those things that we normally don't even think about because we just assume that they're part of the day. It is a cognitive shift designed to make us attentive to the myriad of blessings with which we are surrounded. And then he says at the end of that paragraph, a better way of living than to be driven by a sense of what we lack, the default cognitive mode of a consumer society, right? So the default cognitive mode of a consumer society is to focus on all the things I don't have. The fundamental building blocks of the Leviticus Constitution is to focus on the things that I do have, right? The blessings from God. Then he says, he's talking about the prayer, Modé, he says the first words of this prayer, Modé, not only comes from the same Hebrew root as Todah, give thanksgiving, it is also the root of the word word Yehuda, Jew. We acquired the name from Jacob's fourth son, Judah, who was given it by his mother Leah, who said when he was born, "This time I will thank God." To be a Jew is to offer thanks. You can underline that one a few times. This is the first word we should say each morning. It is the meaning of our name and the constitutive gesture of our faith, to give thanks. Think about that. Think about the difference between that perspective of Judaism and what would you say was Christianity's fundamental word? If Judaism's fundamental word is thanksgiving, what is Christianity's fundamental word? Can I suggest that Christianity's fundamental word is forgiveness? Okay? So, because, I mean, don't we talk about Jesus dying on the cross to forgive us for our sins? But what does that, what is implied if my fundamental word is to be, is forgiveness? It implies that there's something wrong, right? The psychological mentality of Christianity is something is broken. The psychological mentality of Judaism is that God has given. What a shift that is in my mentality, to stop thinking of my world as a mess and me as broken and in need of forgiveness, and to start thinking of my world as an absolute wonder of blessing and awe that I get to experience. Okay? And he says at the end of that page, to be a Jew is to feel a sense of gratitude, to see life itself as a gift, to be able to live through suffering without being defined by it, and thus to give hope the victory over fear. To be a Jew is to offer thanks. I just think that's a fantastic idea. And it's so nice that it helps us reform the book of Leviticus as the instructions about how to give thanks and recognize the awe and beauty of the world, instead of focusing constantly on the need for atonement and forgiveness and confession and on and on and on, right? Changes my mentality about who I am and who God is. Okay. Comments from anyone before we continue? Because now I'm going to go to page 118.
Just how wonderful this all is.
You can still hear me? Oh, Esther, go ahead. You were going to say something?
Just how beautifully described that is, and how true that is, and how we're not aware of it. But it makes complete sense.
Yeah.
And that I want to be the kind of
thing. Yeah, it makes complete sense. Yeah, it makes complete sense, and it also is a dramatic shift in the paradigm. Because, I mean, most of us grew up in the Christian world, and so we were taught that there was something fundamentally wrong with us, and the only way that that could be fixed is for God to renew us, okay? But think about what Sachs has just said about the Constitution of Judaism. The Constitution of Judaism is, what a blessing it is to be alive.
Yes.
I mean, a massive change in my psychology about what the world is all about.
If I may say, the huge difference for me is that when you feel like something is wrong with you, you feel the need for everyone else to be in the category. But when your life is driven by giving things, then there's a lot of room and a lot of freedom for everybody to be who God meant for them to be.
That's a really good point.
It takes away this need to cram everybody in this understanding that we have.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, exactly. And we have an English aphorism, misery loves company, right? So if we feel that there's something wrong with us, the last thing we want is somebody running around being joyful. We'll remind them about how miserable life is. We have this going on in the political world today, right? And Judaism is just the opposite. And what's interesting is that Sachs can say, because Judaism is based on the idea of thanksgiving, you can have hope and joy even in the midst of suffering. Because guess what? You're alive. I mean, it's such a huge difference.
Skip.
Yeah.
Skip.
Let me go to Lise first, okay? Lise, okay. David?
Yeah.
I just enjoyed so much when he discusses what the sages say about Psalm 107 on page 110, and the different events or situations or dangers that are mentioned in Psalm 107 that you should give thanksgiving for. And crossing the sea, crossing the desert, recovery from serious illness, and release from captivity. And I guess for me, myself, when I fell on the recovery from serious illness, I mean, that spoke to me so much, because even today I can be thankful for everything that happened, even though in the very midst of it I was, like, in the middle of crossing the sea. So I hadn't realized that psalm, you know, discussed force very specifically.
But isn't it?
Yeah. So it was very good for me to read that.
Yeah. And I think it's a story like yours is a testament to how different an attitude of thanksgiving is as opposed to an attitude of lack. You know, this is really important because think of that really famous psalm that everybody knows, right? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. But it doesn't actually say, right? It's not like God gives me everything I want. It's that God has ensured that I will not lack in my life. Yes?
You cut out for 1 second.
Somebody. So it dropped me and I'm back now. Can you hear me again?
Yes.
Okay. Let's close the extra window. One of these has to be closed. I'm not sure which one. Yes. Okay, let's try again. How are we doing now? Okay, so now it's a little bit better. So, does somebody still have a hand up? I didn't see. Can you still hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, and there's no hands up.
Okay, great. Just that shift, you know, just think about what would happen in your own life if, when you're struggling with things, like, for example, Roseanne and I are struggling today because she's really ill. If we viewed that as an opportunity to give God thanks for what we have instead of a concern with what we don't have, right? I mean, I think that would make a big difference. Okay, I see somebody has a hand up. But I don't know who it is because it's titled Skip Leviticus. So go ahead. If you're going to speak with your hand up, go ahead.
Hi, it's David. I wanted to say, you know, I had 6 years of sickness, 3 years before my liver I was sick, a year after I had a year of severe pain before my kidney. But even through the worst circumstances, I could always find contentment and comfort, you know, and it was severe pain, especially the kidney, but it was something that I could always through God find comfort and contentment.
Good testimony. Thank you. Okay, Adi asked if I could repeat the statement that I made about Psalm 23, so I'll do that again. So, Psalm 23, as you know, English translation. Can you hear me now?
No, yes. We can.
Yes, no?
Yes, we can, though.
You can. Okay, so let me get through this. The ship is just dropping the connection all the time. What I, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Which, of course, from our perspective, Western perspective, means that I have this whole long list of wants, and God is supposed to supply them, right? But that's not what it says in Hebrew. What it says in Hebrew is, the Lord shepherds me, I have no lack, which is completely different, right? Because lack concentrates on those fundamental things that allow life to continue. And what God, what the psalmist is saying is, God is such a fabulous shepherd that he provides the very thing that caused that keeps my life going, right? So I can bless God and be confident in walking through the valley of the shadow of death because I know that his protection is over me. And that's the same as saying, I don't lack anything. It's very different than I don't want. There's nothing that I don't want, right? You understand the difference? I mean, a huge, huge shift in just that one little English word, unfortunately, in my opinion, mistranslated and sends us in the wrong direction. I wrote about that. In case you're interested, you can look on Today's Word and find it. Pam, you have something you want to add? I see your hand up. Can you hear me? Maybe not. Maybe no one can hear me. Can you hear me now? Does anybody hear
me? Yes.
And you're here.
You can hear me.
We can hear you.
Okay. So I see your hand up, Pamela, but I don't hear you. So I'll just continue. If you want to say something, just break in. Okay? So I want to go to page 118, the last paragraph of that little chapter. Evolutionary psychology has taught us about these genetic residues from earlier times, which, because they are not rational, cannot be cured by reason alone. Stop right there. And think about what we've learned about what's called epigenetics. That is, the ability of my behavior to change the genetics of my DNA that gets passed to the next generation. The really important concept. Look it up sometime. Then he goes on and says, but only by ritual, strict prohibition, and habituation. So what he's saying is behavior changes DNA. That's amazing because it means that how I act will have an impact on what happens to the future generations. And it also means that how people acted in my past affected my DNA, right? This is really, really interesting because of the definition, because of the working definition of the Hebrew word ish, which is translated in lexicons as man, but as you know, it doesn't actually mean that. It means the summary of all the relationships that make me who I am. And of course, the summary of all the relationships is everything that contributed to me through the past, my ancestors, and my responsibility to communicate that to the future. So what he's talking about here in evolutionary psychology is it precisely the Hebrew view of man. Okay, then it says, the contemporary world continues to be scarred by violence and terror. Sadly, the ban against blood sacrifice is still relevant. The instinct against which it is a protest, sacrificing life to exercise fear, still lives on. So that's really interesting because if we think of epigenetics, that means that those cultures whose ancestors behaved in a way that sacrificed humans will continue to change the DNA of the people that they generate, and that culture, that cultural DNA will get passed on. It's like the famous psychologist who believed in ancestral, who was it? Oh, how can I forget his name? Anyway, I've got all of his books on the shelf. I just can't remember now, right? Okay. So let's go over to 119. In her book, The Watchman's Rattle, subtitled Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction, Rebecca Costa delivers a fascinating account of how civilizations die. They do so, she argues, because their problems become too complex. societies reach what she calls cognitive threshold. They simply cannot chart a path from the present to the future. And I would say in my lectures that it's impossible to think our way out of the box. Right? We must have input from outside the civilization, from outside the civilization of humanity itself, if we're going to survive. Wherever the gods have been put in exile, and the civilization relied on its own cognitive abilities, it failed. It collapsed. We are unfortunately right there again. So on 120, the second paragraph, Rebecca Kosas' argument is that whatever the causes, the Mayan collapse, like the fall of the Roman Empire and the Khmer Empire in the 13th century Cambodia, occurred because problems became too many and complicated for the people of that time and place to solve. There was cognitive overload and the systems broke down. Okay, good. I'm glad that there was cognitive overload and the systems broke down, but something else is happening there. That is, the systems stopped relying on an outside input into the system to control the complexity and the system overload, right? So, think of Leviticus as God's instruction to prevent system overload. Okay? You get that? Think of Leviticus as God's instruction to the civilization to prevent system overload. And if you think about that, you might recognize one of the reasons why Judaism has survived 5,000 years and other civilizations haven't. Because Judaism did not rely on its internal cognitive ability to solve its problems. So he goes on, same page, 120. It can happen to any civilization. It may, she says, be happening to ours, and I believe it is. The first sign of breakdown is gridlock. Instead of dealing with what everyone can see are major problems, people continue as usual and simply pass their problems on to the next generation. So Barack Obama would say about the $30 trillion debt, well, it's not our problem now, right? That's the perfect example of blindness in terms of the complexity of the situation. Then she says, the second sign is a retreat into irrationality. That's where we are today. Since people can no longer cope with the facts, they take refuge in religious consolations. The Mayans took to offering sacrifices by the thousands, by the way. Okay? The bottom of the page, last paragraph. But the Pharisees and their heirs, the rabbis, did precisely the opposite of the Mayans and the Khmer. Instead of focusing obsessively on sacrifices, they dedicated their energies to finding substitutes for sacrifice. In the top of the next page, one was given by Yohanan ben Zakkai, comforted Rabbi Yehoshua, who wondered how Israel would atone for its sins without sacrifices, with the words, "My son, we have another atonement as effective as this, acts of kindness. It is written, Hosea 6:6, I desire kindness, not sacrifice." Another was Torah study. So we have compassionate acts and Torah study. The stages interpreted Malachi's words, "In every place offerings are presented in my name," to refer to scholars who study the laws of sacrifice. One who recites the orders of sacrifice is as though he had brought them in from the tenet. Okay? And another was prayer. So now we have three things. Oh, we're going to have four. Okay? He says, take the words with you and return to the land of Israel. You offer your lips as sacrifices to bulls. And he says, he who prays in the house of prayer is as if he brought a pure oblation. And then yet another is Teshuvah. The Psalm 51:19 says, the sacrifices of God are a contrite spirit. From the sages, we infer that if a person repents, it is accounted to him as if he'd gone to Jerusalem and built a temple and altar and offered on a sacrifice ordained in the Torah. And the fifth is fasting. So here we have them. Acts of kindness, Torah study, prayer, repentance, and fasting. the fight to circumvent the ingrowing complexity of the society that will ultimately bring it down. Okay? He says, what is striking in hindsight is how, rather than clinging to the past, sages like Rabban Yohanan thought forward to a worst-case scenario future. And then the short answer to that is that overwhelmingly the prophets, this is the last paragraph, the sages and the Jewish thinkers of the Middle Ages realized that sacrifices were symbolic enactments to process of processes of mind, heart, and deed that could be expressed in other ways as well. Okay? So important to understand what was really happening with sacrifice. Right? What was really happening with sacrifice was not, a ritual of blood offering. That might look like the behavior, but what was behind it was this process by which I had rituals that would help me maintain the continuity of the society despite all of the trauma that the civilization was experiencing. And as Sarah just mentioned, that the sixth one was hospitality, which is certainly part of the Arab culture. Okay, so let's go to the bottom of page 122, the statement in the last sentence. Finding substitutes for sacrifice, yeah. They showed... Yes.
Sorry, can you explain how hospitality becomes... it says, let me see. As long as the temple stood, the altar atoned for Israel, but now a person's table atones for him. How... What does he mean by that?
The sixth is hospitality, yes. Okay. So, as long as the temple stood, the altar atoned for Israel, right? So the altar was the place where you brought your sacrifice and showed your devotion to God, right? But it also healed your relationship with other people. Remember when Yeshua says, if you come to the altar and you have something and there's something against you, leave it and go and take care of that. So the process of sacrifice in the altar required not just purity with God, but harmony with others. Okay? So without the temple, how am I going to do that? Now a person's table atones for him. Why? Because what's the table about? The table is not simply that I'm going to eat my meal. The table is my ability to welcome someone in and serve them in a way that I would cement the relationship, fulfill the commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, and cement the relationship so that when I present the blessing over the food at the table to God, I've included that process that would have been taken care of before I brought the sacrifice to the altar. Does that help? Yes?
Yeah, no? Well, it speaks to me because I've been telling Dave for the past while, I'm tired of always being the one that have people over. And now, I haven't read this page yet. So now it sort of really speaks to me that we have to just keep doing that because it's part of what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. It is essentially the replacement for the altar temple sacrifice. And, right?
Yeah.
It achieves the same function. Right? It not only honors God because he gave you the gift that you're now giving back to him, but it opens the way for the enhancement of relationship with others. So it meets both commandments that Yeshua marks as the ones that on which all the law and the prophets are strung, right? It meets both of them at the same time, to love your neighbor as yourself and to love God with everything that you have.
Thank you. That's
okay.
Very insightful. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, let's go to the bottom of 122, the last sentence. Finding substitutes for sacrifice, they showed how a civilization inspired by eternity can defeat death itself. Well, you can mark that one. Because look what he said. He said those things that substituted for sacrifice, and we listed six of them, okay? Those things... are slices of eternity embedded in the rituals of a civilization. And that's the only thing that keeps the civilization alive. Okay, we got some feedback from somebody there. Did you hear what I said? Yes? Okay, let's go one more time, right? This is really important because think about what happens when you give up or when you prohibit those six substitutes for sacrifice. Think about what that implies for the sustainability of the civilization. If what Sachs is saying is right, any civilization that actually gives up those six things is bound to be defeated because it will become a civilization of death, not a civilization of life. Okay? All right. So that takes us to this next little chapter. And I want to go all the way over to 127 unless somebody has a comment. Oh, Pam, you have a comment? I see your hand up, Pamela, but we don't hear you. Yeah, don't hear you. Okay. Lower all hands, I guess. Okay, let's go to 127, the middle paragraph. He's talking about, again, sacrifices, and he says, Moses now begins a difficult dialogue with God. He asks for God's face to go with the people. He asks God to help him understand his ways. He then asks to see God's glory. I've written about this a lot because it's the text is so interesting and so complicated, deep. Okay? And he says, none of these terms is simple. One in particular, the concept of face, seems to be ambiguous. God speaks to Moses face to face, but a few verses later he says, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. There seems to be a difference between speaking and seeing face to face. Much of this is obscure, but what is clear is that all of these terms have to do with the different modes through which God manifests himself to human beings. Okay? So why have I outlined it or underlined this paragraph? Because I love this sentence. Much of this is obscure. Remember what we said at the beginning of this session. We should not expect the Bible to provide us with all these clarifying answers. In fact, we would be amazed. In fact, we might even think that it was a human invention if there were answers to everything. Right? What we discover in the biblical text is that there are a lot of loose ends. And this verse is one of the loose ends. And I've written a lot about the transition when God passes in front of Moses, because it's involved with a birth story. It's involved with the future as the past. It's involved with not seeing the back of God, but seeing what God is going to do. It's involved with giving Moses a direction for his leadership. All that kind of stuff is happening inside the text of this story. And rather than repeat it all here, if you just go to those verses in the Today's Word search box, you'll come up with all the stuff that's actually happening inside of this. And what's really interesting is it's happening in texts that are very difficult to understand, because on the surface they seem so obtuse and pedestrian, I guess. Okay? So let's go to the next page, 128. There's a couple of paragraphs on here. And the second paragraph. God had already made it clear at the beginning of this chapter that direct personal closeness could be too dangerous. If the people sin and there is no intermediary between them and him, there will be no way of avoiding divine wrath capable of destroying them. Now he explains further. In language strikingly similar to the words in which he explained his identity to Moses at the burning bush, I will be what I will be, he now says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. God is free. This is really important paragraph. God is free. It is only because God is free that human beings too are free. Therefore, God cannot be predicated or predicted or constrained. Justice and compassion are matters of ultimate choice. Judges must practice justice. Parents may exercise compassion. But God is both a judge and a parent. There is no way of knowing, therefore, which way God will choose. So there is no way of excluding uncertainty from the divine human encounter. You can underline that one about 4 or 5 times. There is no way of excluding uncertainty, right? But what does the Western mind want? The Western mind craves certainty. We want to know for sure. And what has Sachs just said? Because God is free, there is no way to know for sure, right? You have his promises, but even the promises are based on the free will of God. No one can constrain God to act in a certain way and obligate him to do so. God can obligate himself, which he does with Abraham, but just because you say, oh God, forgive me, does not mean he is obligated to do that. He freely chooses to, but it's the freedom of his action that makes it valid, not the obligation. Okay? So, let's look at the bottom of the page. There can be little doubt that despite, perhaps even because of, the obscurity of this passage, we're in the presence of one of the turning points in Jewish history. It bears a striking resemblance to the episode in which Jacob wrestles with the angel alone at night. And, of course, he's added angel. I would argue that angel isn't the proper word there. They have a number of features in common. They share a key word, face. It occurs multiple times in both passages. Jacob, after the encounter, calls the place where it occurred Peniel, saying, I have seen God face to face and survived. Right? Okay. So if you want to see the depth of that expression in Sachs, go read my book, Crossing. Because what it really says is that Jacob doesn't see God. He sees God in himself, and it changes who he is. He wrestles with his own identity. And, of course, that identity is built on God's choice of Jacob as the progenitor of the tribes. Okay? Now, let's go down a little bit further. The last full paragraph. A new word enters the relationship between God and the people. The word is Shehen, to dwell among. Hitherto, this had been a word used exclusively of humans. Now it is given a local habitation and name. Let them make me a sanctuary, a mikdash, and I will dwell, vashikahani, among them. Right? So all of a sudden, what does this mean? That now we have the divine presence in Israel. Isn't it interesting that Sachs points out that that hadn't occurred before this? There's lots of interaction with God, the patriarchs, but until this point, God is not dwelling with his people in this very spectacular way. Okay, let's go over to 130. He says, the top of the page, the result would be a form of divine presence known in rabbinic Hebrew as the Shekinah. Very different from God of creation, who makes universes, and the God of redemption, who overthrows empires. This is the God who is close, who can be met in fixed places at predictable times, who travels with the people in the desert, and will later be with them even in exile. This God is Shekhen, as neighbor, and also Kavod, glory. This is the God, this is God, as he gives a specific kind of dignity to man. And the next two paragraphs are really, really important, but I want to pause right here to make sure that we understand what's actually happened here, right? That the building of the tabernacle created the space for God to dwell with his people and change the relationship between God and the chosen people, right? That God now is the intimate neighbor of human beings, okay? not the God of creation, not the God who walked in the garden, not the God of redemption, not the God of punishment and wrath, not the God of Noah, right? He's now the intimate neighbor. And he says that changes the kind of dignity to man. Now he says in the next paragraph, we can define the nature of this dignity, for it is the single most striking difference between the chapters that follow the golden calf and those that precede it. Remember, Leviticus is the book that's written after the golden calf, okay? So, while human beings have been the object of divine action, now, for the first time, the people become active. They build the tabernacle. They contribute to its upkeep. They are able to bring sacrifices. They support a priesthood that, in turn, acts as guardians of the holy for the sake of the people. There is an order and routine in the religious life. In place of the unique intercession of Moses in the dialogue with God, there is now to be an annual Day of Atonement at which the high priest will confess the atonement for the sins of the people. Religious life has been rescued from the vagaries of chance to the predictability of order and structure. The fear of the Israelites felt in the absence of Moses has been acknowledged, and a decision has been taken that it should not happen again. Okay? So why do I need the temple? You know, as a place to offer sacrifices for atonement? No. I need the temple because the temple reminds me that leadership by God is always present. And therefore, I must have a substitute for the temple when it's destroyed, because without it, I will not have the symbol of God's leadership. Right? I no longer fear because I have the substitute of the temple, which reminds me that God is in charge. Okay? And he says on 131, first paragraph, but the Israelites needed more. Such was the essence of Moses' request. Yes, they knew that God, sovereign of the universe, was their king, but they needed to experience him also as Shachen, a neighbor. And then the last paragraph on the same page. And so, in a sense, it has remained. Nowhere do we see this more vividly than by comparing the great cathedrals of Europe with synagogues. Right? The cathedrals were built to express the vastness of God and the smallness of man. The synagogues, small and simple, convey the closeness of God and the potential greatness of mankind. Boy, you can underline that one. I spend a lot of time in the great cathedrals, and they make you feel small on purpose, because the cathedrals are homages to the Creator God, right? The synagogue, which, you know, basically is a minion, doesn't take very many people, right? The synagogue is complete, the feeling of it, it should be completely different. Not an overwhelming statement of the awe and greatness of God, but a feeling of this intimacy and closeness with the divine. Okay? End of the paragraph, or end of the little chapter. So, comments before we try to continue? We only have a few more minutes. Right?
Hi, Skip. This is Maddie.
Go ahead, yes. Go ahead, Maddie.
I was thinking about the hospitality. I was just explaining to somebody last night how I ended up as a Jew. And I remember I attended a class with my friend Sarah, who was giving her a degree. And I audited the class. And after the class, I called you. And I was not a student. I just was auditing. And I told you that you just pulled the rug out from underneath my Christian beliefs. And you invited us to a Shabbat dinner in Orlando.
Yeah.
So that was hospitality. And that literally changed the whole direction of my life.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm glad. It's been a great honor to know you and David.
Yes, same here.
Yeah. Anybody else want to make a comment on the cathedral synagogue statement? I can tell you that I shoot lots of photography, and I love to shoot the ceilings of cathedrals all over Europe, and I've done a lot of them, over 100. And I'm always impressed by the magnificence of the cathedral because they are all attempts to reach up to God, right? The cathedral ceilings are 50, 60, 70 feet in the air. They are always elaborate, awesome creations where you wonder how in the world a guy could have painted that over 7 years, all that kind of stuff. But it never makes you feel close. It always makes you feel the distance. And in particular, the spatial distance. And it's interesting that Zach's comment would be that synagogues work exactly the opposite way, right? That the intention of the synagogue is to draw you into a close relationship. And that really makes me wonder about the synagogue in Florence, the one in Prague, where they've almost pushed the limits of what it means to have a synagogue because they built these magnificent structures, of course, with good intention, but it changes the feeling of the place. Okay? Really interesting. Okay. Let's see if we can handle one or two more comments before we run out of time today. We'll just try to do this next little section. So I only have two comments. One is on page 139. It's the italicized sentence near the bottom of the page. And it's a fundamental summary of Leviticus, the order of the priest. To be holy is to make distinctions, to recognize and honor the divine order of creation. So, interestingly enough, to recognize those distinctions is not simply to recognize a set of rules, but to honor the divine order of creation. So this is interesting because what it says is Leviticus wasn't an accidental addition needed after the sin of the golden calf. Leviticus was always built into the idea of the creation. Because God ordered things right from the beginning, and more than any other cosmological mythology, the creation account in Genesis is about bringing order to chaos. It starts off with verse 2, and the world, the world was filled with chaos and void, and God brought order. So God is the order-making God from the very beginning, right? And Leviticus is simply the elaboration of what that order looks like, already built into the creation, now expanded in such a way so that we have the directions and the instruction that that was needed. Okay? And now he makes a comment on 141 in relation to the question that always comes up in Christian circles, the dietary laws. And he says, second paragraph on page 141. The sanctuary, with its partitions, represents boundary making in space. The dietary laws, with their divisions of permitted and forbidden, represent boundary making in life. Isn't that interesting? Right? So, this is really interesting because I have been asked many, many times, well, what's the reason for the dietary laws? It must be about, health, and you don't eat shrimp because of the garbage cans of the ocean. No, that's not the case. The Bible never provides a medical answer to that kind of question. It doesn't provide a health-based answer. Sachs provides the answer. What's the answer? It represents boundary making in life. It represents the ability to set aside some things that sustain life from other things. That's all. It's just a reflection of another boundary condition that God put in place from the very beginning and did not elaborate until we get to the constitutional document of Judaism, Leviticus. Okay? Well, I think we're finished for today. We're going to start again next time on 144, which is really, really great because it's all about the concealment of creation. But I'm more than willing to entertain anybody who wants to add comments on what we talked about today or something that we missed or something else. So please go ahead. Pam, I see your hand is up again. Maybe now we can hear you. Go
ahead. Can you hear me now?
Huh? Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I have a lot. I've been writing notes. Is there a way that I can correspond with you maybe via email?
Sure.
And ask you questions?
Just send me an email. It's really simple. You can go, if you go to the website, there's a contact email right on there.
Okay. Because I have a question about atonement versus forgiveness to explore.
Yeah. Okay. In fact, just writing about that the other day. Yeah. Okay. That'd be perfect. Sure. Okay. Anybody else have a comment that you want to add before we close today?
I just wanted to share an experience Dave and I had. We went to a small town, 2,000 people on the south shore of the province. And there's a huge, they call it the cathedral because they built it, 150 years ago. So we actually got to visit it with people inside, giving us different, information. And when you walk in this church, it's like a church of marble. Like everything it's just this beautiful marble that's everywhere.
Columns and the
roof, everything. So we get to one station where there's a painter. The painter says, everybody must be impressed with all of this marble that's around you. To find out that Quebec, there's no marble in Quebec. And so 150 years ago, there was a painter who painted all the columns of the whole church.
The wood columns.
And they were wood that he painted as if it would look like marble. And it was an amazing shock. So there are many, many churches that just look wonderful, but inside, it's good painting. I mean, there's creativity. I'm not, but it was like, I still haven't been able to process everything that it just sort of gave me a shock on, these huge cathedrals and churches that we have. So anyway, just thought I'd share that for the fun of it.
Okay.